Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White. I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Aaron Maddox of Coramdale Church. Pastor Chris Hemmelman, who's usually with us, is out today. But on Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the long lifespans in Genesis. And speaking of questions, we're taking some listener questions on this episode.
Yeah, we're going to tackle a number of things. First, I want to mention that this is a five Wednesday month. Anytime there's five Wednesdays in a month, we usually release an archive episode for the fifth Wednesday. We don't do a live show. We're not going to do that this month. We're putting all our energies toward the 500th episode of the Wednesday Conversation,
man,
which releases on November 13th. So we're not going to do a fifth episode in October. So you won't see an archive episode. You're going to pull up your phone on that Wednesday just longing to hear our voices, and you'll be like, oh, dang, there's nothing there. So just want you to know that. But I also want to say thank you to Camille from Long Island, who's like one of my favorite listeners to this podcast. She's been a listener for years.
Yeah.
Camille reached out and said, hey, I heard you're having a 500th episode. I'm buying pizza for everybody.
Let's go.
So She said, just tell me the pizzeria. Tell me the date. I'm calling it in. Camille, we love you.
Camille's great. Remember when she visited?
Yeah. Thanks for being one of our best fans on the East Coast on Long Island.
Hey, fun story. I was at the gym prior to working out.
Yeah, you sent me a photo of this. This is crazy.
And I don't do this all the time, but sometimes I'll go to the gym and then read my Bible and journal and stuff there instead of doing it at my house because, I don't know, man, there's a lot of kids there, you know? So I'll go to the gym early and do it while I was doing it. And this trainer guy walks by who I've developed a relationship with, and I was reading Genesis, and he goes, man, Genesis 6 is crazy. And I was like, hey, actually, me and some friends just recorded a podcast on it. I should say I sat in the room while some friends recorded a podcast on it. It wasn't really accurate, but because we all know that. And he was like, man, yeah, the Nephilim. I was like, this is crazy that you're talking to me about this because we literally just did that yesterday. So anyway.
Was this the guy that had the t-shirt or was that a different guy?
Different guy has the t-shirt on. So the same day he brings this up, talking to another friend that he works out with. And, you know, like, I'm the guy at the gym who doesn't really talk to people.
It's because you have your phone set up on the tripod filming.
No, absolutely not. I'm the guy who goes to the gym to just work out and leave.
Yeah, that's what we all used to do.
Church is my community. Okay. So we're joking about the Nephilim, and I flex at the guy and said, like, I am the Nephilim. And then the other guy pulls up his sweatshirt, shows me his t-shirt, and it says something about the Nephilim.
Yeah.
And I sent that to you.
Sent me a photo of this guy. Dusty's at the gym next to this guy, and his shirt is just like has some reference to the Nephilim.
Nephilim are everywhere.
I'm going to pull up the photo because I was like, this can't be real. On the day we recorded a podcast. Yeah.
So crazy.
It says his shirt says Camp Nephilim.
That's awesome.
Which makes me wonder, is that a real camp or did somebody just like think that'd be a cool camp?
I think you just made
Camp Nephilim.
And it's Goliath on the
shirt. Yeah.
Aaron there pointed out it is Goliath.
So
that's a crazy story.
Shout out to the guys at the gym listening to our Nephilim podcast. I thought that was a decent one. I had fun talking about the Nephilim. And guess what? It generated questions from listeners. We heard from a few folks. One was Josh Allen. Not the quarterback.
Like the quarterback. The Bill?
I just wanted to say that just to say, yeah, the Buffalo Bills quarterback reached out. He had some questions about the Nephilim. Actually, it's another Josh Allen. But Josh Allen, our listener, it has to be cool to have the same. This has to happen to you regularly where people are like, wait, is this Josh Allen? And you're like, yes, but not that Josh Allen. But we also got an email from Aaron Morrow, Dubuque, Iowa, River City Church. I know you from afar, Aaron. I don't think we've ever met in person, or if we have, it's been a long time, but hey, he reached out asking Aaron if we would sort of reflect a little bit more on Michael Heiser's work, because we mentioned his book, The Unseen Realm, which was helpful in thinking about some of those texts in Genesis 6. Apparently, there's more Michael Heiser content out there. There's a documentary on YouTube, and he said, hey, I know some pastors who've watched this, and I appreciate some of what Heiser's doing, but I have some questions. His specific question was that Heiser seems to think that both angels and humans share the image of God. I had this conversation with you when I first read his work, because I was like, okay, the Bible tells us Genesis 1, man and woman are in the image of God. It doesn't use that same language for angels, but Heiser is very convictional about that there's a both and there. Yeah. How would you sort of respond to the question of like, what do we do with that?
Yeah. What Heiser's trying to do is he's looking at the function that humans play in the biblical story and the function that angels or spiritual beings play in the biblical story. And he's noting that there's some similarities, essentially that God is going to work through both humans and spiritual beings to accomplish his purposes in the world. And this is kind of an oversimplification, but that leads Heiser to essentially say, well, if humans are made in the image of God, and part of what Heiser sees the image of God being as is like a functional, representational role, then he's essentially just mapping that language of image of God onto spiritual beings because they're doing functionally vocational stuff just like humans are. And
are you persuaded, not persuaded, or indifferent?
I see how he gets there. I want to keep the image of God language to human beings.
Yeah.
So while I'm perfectly okay with saying that functionally there's maybe similarities that God's working through both spiritual beings and human beings, I see that throughout the biblical story, the particular language of image of God seems to be uniquely reserved for human beings. And I think that's really important to maintain that. So
I'm glad to hear you say that because that's how I feel. Yeah. When I read Michael Heiser, he talks about imagers. Yeah. And he's talking about angels. I'm like, no, I'm not going to, I don't like that word because it's not how the Bible talks about it. I knew you were enough of a Bible guy to, but you also are a guy that likes to be very nuanced and say, well, let's give some freedom here for people to explore things.
And so. I think what I do appreciate overall Heiser's work because what he's doing, he's a really good text guy. And so when he gets into the text, he's noticing these similarities. You're seeing that as you're reading his work, he's just showing where all these places are, where there is overlap and where the biblical story seems to be God is wanting to accomplish his work through both spiritual beings and human beings. And so I'm sympathetic to how he's getting to that conclusion, but I do think there's something unique about human beings in the biblical story where, you know, to jump into the New Testament, Paul's going to say, don't you know that one day you're going to rule or judge the spiritual beings? You're going to judge the angels. So there's a unique role human beings have that I think is important that we maintain.
Aaron Morrow has concerns about how this maps onto atonement when Heiser starts getting into New Testament stuff, which I'm not familiar with, so I can't speak to that. But yeah. Aaron, I think that's of Aaron Morrow, listener. I think that's a fair question to have. I don't know how it seems to me that if you draw too tight of a connection between humans and angels, it is going to affect how you understand the atonement and specifically what has Christ done for human beings. That's distinct. Obviously, the angels don't benefit from the atonement.
Sure.
Peter says this is something angels long to look into is the gospel.
Yep.
So good question there, Aaron. And I'm sorry that we can't speak more fully. I haven't studied Heiser's work exhaustively. I thought he was helpful on Genesis 6, but I don't want to wholesale affirm everything he says or wholesale throw out everything he says. And I don't have enough familiarity to answer much more than that. So, hey, 500th episode. November 13th, make sure you get that one. It's going to be fun. We're going to have a good time. We're
special
going to
bring
back special guests who've been on the podcast in the past. It should be fun. But today, we want to tackle another Genesis question. And the way we summarize it is just to say, let's talk about these long lifespans in Genesis. Let me read from Genesis chapter 5, verse 3. When Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness after his image, and named him Seth. Seems like he's pretty old when he had Seth. But keep reading. The days of Adam after he fathered Seth were 800 years. And he had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days that Adam lived were 930 years. And he died. In Genesis 5, and then later on in Genesis 9 and 10, you get these really long lifespans. And you start to read this and you're like, well, I sure don't know anyone who's lived 930 years. Aaron, I don't know if we're talking about
a long time.
Wizards or hobbits, or I mean, sounds like in mystery and fantasy novels, maybe.
But. It's a great question because when you read the Bible with your kids, they're asking. This is one of the questions they're asking right away. Like, whoa, that's a long time.
Yeah. Didn't Grandpa die when he was 100? It seemed like he was old, but Adam was 930.
Then you have the Psalm saying, "By reason 80."
Yeah,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, Psalm 90
that goes back to that feels a little bit more reasonable.
Yeah.
So this is a question that we're going to make Aaron Maddox talk about. But it's a question that every writer on Genesis sort of tackles this. I've got sitting in front of me five different commentaries or books on Genesis, and every one of these writers has to treat this, because they realize this is an odd feature of the Genesis mm-hmm. accounts, is that they have these very long lifespans, and it does seem unusual to a modern reader and to really any reader throughout history, because, you know, if you go in the Old Testament and ask how long did this king reign, yeah. the lifespans of the kings are much more similar to ours, 70 years, 80 years, 90 years, maybe 50 or 40, depending on if yeah. they died in battle. So when you read about someone who lived 900 years, it just is a little odd.
Yeah, it feels odd, and it, you know, in many ways it is odd. And I think it's, you know, maybe what's helpful here is to maybe just work through a few different ways people have tried to explain, you know, what's happening here in Genesis 5. You know, if you take it at face value, it's interesting. Noah is still going to be alive by the time Abraham's born, and Shem is going to outlive Abraham by 35 years. And so just interesting, you know, data points. Like, if we are to take these as, to use the word literal, that's what we have. You know, some people who are going to take these numbers as literal are going to say something to the effect of, prior to the flood, you know, the biological environment of the earth was different, and it allowed people to live this long. And after the flood, what you do notice is that these lifespans do slowly decrease, and they become more and more close to what we would consider normal. So that is one way people have tried to interpret these views, not necessarily in that same, this is kind of a young earth creation camp, not necessarily in that same camp, but similar to taking these numbers as, you know, on the face value, many of the reformers actually did themselves. And so Calvin in particular, I was just reading and kind of researching for this, makes the point that maybe the reason why these ages were so prolonged was to allow Adam and these first human beings to continue to pass on everything that happened in the Garden of Eden to successive descendants, and that there's a preserving the revelation that God gave from early on to keep going. So that's, you know, just putting that out there as a particular option. So some people disagree with that. Some people agree with that. One of the other options that I found interesting, and I'm not, you know, 100% sure where I land on this, is the distinction that some scholars make between sacred numbers and real numbers. And so real numbers are kind of what they sound like, how we just use numbers in everyday.
Does this take me back to high school calculus, where there's like imaginary numbers there, and stuff?
We might. It might. This is,
that's where I got lost. I was like, anything outside a real number, I don't know what we're talking about.
Well, sacred numbers is the pattern that, if you were to kind of just back up 1 second and think about the genealogies, both for ancient Israel and Israel's neighbors, that there's a common pattern of these large lifespans, both for the Hebrew Bible and in Babylonian and Assyrian cultures. And then more so, the Babylonian and Assyrians have extraordinarily even larger numbers, like 20,000 years, 30,000 years, as far as lifespans go. And so what scholars sometimes will talk about is sacred numbers are used to give sort of religious dignity or respect to important persons in their own history. And so when people kind of look at these numbers, again, I'm not saying this is, you know, 100% true or whatnot, but just putting it as an option, there's 30 numbers in total in Genesis 5. So there's 10 generations, 3 numbers per generation. So you have the age of when the son was born, the number of years lived after that son is born, and then the total number of years that patriarch lived. So that's where you get 30 numbers, 10 generations from Adam to Noah. And then if we were to kind of fast forward a little bit, there's 10 generations from after Noah to Abraham. So there's 10 and 10. So just looking at Genesis 5 for a second, in all 30 numbers, they end with either the digits 0, 2, 5, 7, or 9. And so this is where it gets a little bit into the weeds here.
But it feels like we're about to hit a conspiracy theory. But if you add all those numbers up, they get us to aliens.
It reminds me of the number. Remember that? Did you guys ever watch Lost?
No.
But there's a sequence of numbers that they repeat over and over again, so it almost sounds like okay. That. But for listeners out there. Anyway, they end, all 30 numbers end in either 0, 2, 5, 7, or 9. And so mathematically, to get 30 numbers to end in one of those 5 digits, people smarter than me do the math, is 1 in 100 million. Which leads people to go, well, there's maybe some intentionality by the authors to like get these numbers to end in one of those 5 digits. And so what ends up happening then is each of these numbers could then be constructed. Think of it as like these are like little Lego bricks, if you will. Each of these numbers in Genesis 5 can be constructed in either multiples of 60 or 7. Now, this is where the sacred number thing comes into play, because 60 would have been a very religious or kind of important number for the Babylonian culture. The Babylonian mathematical system, which we actually still have inherited in many ways, it was based on the sexagesimal system that we still use today. So like 60 miles per hour, 60 seconds in a minute, you know, or 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes, you know, that whole, how we think about time. So 60 comes from the Babylonians, and then 7 is a very Hebrew Jewish number. And so whether it's either 60 months, which equals 5 years, or 60 years, or 7 years, a combination of those three things, 5 years, which is 60 months, or 60 years by itself, or 7 years, all three of those sort of like Lego bricks can equal all those 30 numbers in Genesis 5. So to kind of sum this up, what someone would say then is that the biblical author, Moses, we presume, is doing a little bit of polemical work here, saying that these numbers here in Genesis 5 are, yes, in some ways connected to Israel's neighbors, the Babylonians. But what the Genesis 5 narrative is saying is that these are the actual, like, important people for Israel to pay attention to, okay, not so those other surrounding myths.
Good. So time out for a second. Perhaps it's important to note, most listeners maybe already know this, but I think it's important to state that how we approach journalistic integrity as modern Americans is different than how the biblical writers would have thought about this. So I think we think like, hey, if you're telling me Adam lived 930 years and he actually lived 90 years, you're lying to me. So we expect sort of like factual accuracy in an account like this. But when you recall that this is theological history, this is a certain kind of literature, and they're not following modern journalistic standards, that's all okay. You can, the inspiration of scripture is not troubled in any way by that fact. Second, it might be interesting to draw in John Collins' observation in his book, Reading Genesis Well, where he asks, we should consider what effect these numbers would have on an ancient audience. Quite apart from whether there's some kind of symbolism in these numbers, on their face, they create a sense of distance between the characters and the audience. So what they even do this for us, they make us think like, well, that's a whole different world if somebody's lived 930 years. And actually what Collins points out is compared to Psalm 90, where it says, you know, the days of our life are 70 years, or if by reason of strength, 80. He's saying that's most of our world, and that's most of the original audience's world. So if they're reading about characters that, you know, whatever the function of these numbers are, whether they are symbolic or real, they at the very least create a sense of like, wow, that's a whole different kind of world from the world we inhabit now. That's part of the function.
And it's elevating the Genesis author, Moses, is trying to elevate these 10 figures, in particular in Genesis 5, as saying like, these are the people you need to remember as part of your family history. And that there are, yes, there are these competing cultural narratives out there that have another list of 10, but no, Israel, these are, this is your family history. This is what you need to hold on to.
So thinking about that polemic strategy is interesting. I was, so I tried to do, I didn't do all the deep work you did, Aaron, but I was reading Bruce Waltke's commentary on Genesis, and most of the commentators mention what's called this Sumerian king list. You can go look this up on Google if you want to. The Sumerian culture is one of the earliest human civilizations we have records for. It's like the oldest civilization that has left us any tablets or history or writing of any kind. The Sumerian king list is the one you mentioned that talks about people living 20,000 or 30,000 years. But here's the footnote in Bruce Waltke. The Sumerian king list can be understood by dividing the regnal years of the king by 602, the ideal constant. So apparently in that culture, there was like, you, everybody just knew like 602 is the ideal constant. You just divide everything by that. And it works out to the actual number. And so it's like, there's a reading strategy here of, there might be cultural background and knowledge that they all just understood. Oh, this is how we treat numbers like this, that we just don't have that same. So that fact makes you realize maybe there's a whole shared understanding of how numbers work in a culture that we just lack as Americans. The interesting thing in the footnote is it mentions that this is base 60 squared. So it's tying into that same point you talked about with Babylonian culture, which I think is interesting. If you think about, I want to give readers so that, because I'm always mindful, like, I, you know, some readers are going to be skeptical, like, you guys are just like just making stuff up with the Bible. But I want to remind you, think about the number 666 in Revelation, right? And think about, like, there are two things Christians have done with that number. One is to get super weird about it and imagine, like, hey, make sure your license plate doesn't have 666 on it. It's the mark of the beast, man. Make sure you're, you know, make sure nothing in your house has that number on it. But actually what most respectable biblical scholars have done is to say that's John's way of communicating something to the original audience in sort of like a coded way of what, especially connected to probably the Roman Emperor Nero. So there there are immediate connections to John's readers that that number makes a certain kind of sense to. And I think you have the same thing going on in Genesis, where there's a symbolic importance to these numbers that we just lack the sort of cultural knowledge to enter into.
Yeah. And I think that's, it's important to just name those. There's ways where these numbers can get really weird, really fast. And then there's ways where we just ignore it and like don't even try. And so there's somewhere in the middle that I think we're trying to thread that needle a little bit here. It is interesting when you think about, you know, the role that genealogies had for Israel and its neighbors. I was coming across a few different pieces of work. A scholar in the 1970s, professor at Yale, was right in the thick of all these debates between, you know, historical critical scholars that were saying these genealogies are just proof that Genesis and the literature is just all made up. And then people who were saying, no, these are actually reliable historical sources. We need to take this at face value. This is literal. And the scholar Robert Wilson, the professor at Yale, went into a deep dive doing all the work of, hey, how did genealogies function, not just in Israel's culture, but in all the different Babylonian, Assyria, so on and so forth. And his conclusion was pretty interesting. He says, our work on biblical as well as extra-biblical genealogies indicates that genealogies are not normally created for the purpose of conveying historical information. They are not intended to be pure historical records. Rather, in the Bible, as well as in other ancient Near Eastern literature and the anthropological material, genealogies seem to have been created and preserved for domestic, political, and religious purposes, and historical information is preserved in the genealogies as well. What he's getting at is that there's a polemical function for these genealogies to elevate one's sort of story, one's culture. And at the same time, what he's kind of threading this needle is that he's going to note that anytime you see a genealogy in the ancient Near East, the people named in them were real historical people in the minds of those authors. So this isn't just complete made up fairy tale nonsense. This is history rooted in a real past, but done in like what we're talking about, a theological or a polemical way to say, no, our narrative, our story is the true story of the world. Hmm.
Let me read another insight from Bruce Waltke that might help listeners. This is an angle you haven't mentioned yet, Aaron, and I don't know who this scholar is, Barnaween, but he has proposed connections between the ages of the antediluvians, that means before the flood, that's these people in Genesis, and the astronomical periods known to the Babylonians. For instance, Enoch's 365 years equal the days of the year. Lamech's 777 years equal the synodic periods of Jupiter plus Saturn. And Jared's 962 years equal the synodic periods of Venus plus Saturn. Also, if the sum of the years at the time of fathering and of the total lifespans from Adam to Lamech are each divided by 60, based on the Babylonian sexagesimal system, the sum of the remainders is 365. Again, perhaps representing the perfect lifespan. So he's noting that there, if the Babylonians were very fascinated by sort of astronomy and the movement of the planets and the, you know, there are ways that perhaps these numbers are even sort of polemically connecting to their fascination with those. So it's interesting. There's I sort of come away from this saying, at the very least, I need to acknowledge there are possibly things going on with these numbers in the strategy of the author that I just need to say, maybe I don't have all the details I need to understand all that's going on.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what another insight that I found super fascinating was that when you do the compare and contrast between the 10 here in Genesis 5 and then the other 10 from the Sumerian kings list, the seventh from the first, so this is Enoch in Genesis 5, and then it's this very strange name, Enumeradoranki, however you pronounce that. Both of those, the seventh from the first genealogy, get a little bit of extra airtime, if you will. Mm-hmm. In Genesis 5, it's Enoch. He walked with God and God took him. But then this Enumeradoranki person, whoever he might be, is someone that later, there's other Babylonian texts where Nebuchadnezzar says, no, I'm a descendant from him. And it's like Nebuchadnezzar elevating himself and saying, no, I am like a semi-god because of this connection. But here in Genesis 5, no, this is saying, no, the actual way to live is to walk with God. And that's like put forth as like this model sort of way. And so there's like, it's just interesting, this compare and contrast that even within the sequence of the genealogies, seem to be doing something in conversation with perhaps Israel's neighbors.
That's fascinating. And just so you know, as a listener, if you connect, so the Sumerian culture, which is the oldest Mesopotamian culture we know of outside the Bible, was taken over eventually by the Babylonians. Babylon was eventually conquered by the Assyrians. The Assyrians are also known as the Chaldeans. So they're basically this whole succession of peoples that as you read through the Old Testament, there are these various empires, mm-hmm. but they all sort of are built on, they all occupy the same ground in the Middle East, yeah. and they're all sort of built on one another. So it's like when you have, like, for instance, you mentioned Nebuchadnezzar,
yeah.
right, who's a later figure in the Old Testament, but he's leaning on this sort of history of yes. empire yeah. that goes back to the earliest days of the human civilization yeah. that he's a part of. So it's helpful. Sometimes as Bible readers, you read about like Baal or Chemosh or Molech, these false gods in the Old Testament, or you read about the Assyrians or the, you know, there's so many names of peoples.
Sure.
As we sort of joked about last time with all the names of the Hivites and the Jebusites and the Hittites and so forth. And so sometimes you can get lost in all the names, but it's important to recognize that there's sort of like a history of empire here, specifically to the north of Israel, mm-hmm. that is the most significant global power of the day. The most significant enemies are usually either Assyria, Babylon, or Egypt
yep.
to the north or south. And these kingdoms have long histories and are trying to, as you could imagine, like think about the Cold War, mm-hmm. right? Who's going to win, the U.S. or Russia, the USSR? These are two kind of global empires, at least in my lifetime. In the same way, if you think about who are Israel's most threatening enemies, it's yep. it's these two empires. And so you can understand why the writers who are yep. preserving Israel's theological history want to say, hey, don't be swayed by the stories these two empires are yep. going to tell you. Here's the real story. Here's the true story yep. of the world and the true story yep. of your ancestors.
Yep, for sure.
All right, Aaron. So we've talked about genealogies as far as just the vastness of the numbers. What else is helpful to think about as we just try to read genealogies intelligently?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that in the biblical genealogies that they're not necessarily giving you every single person in a particular genealogy. In other words, we've talked about this briefly before. We can't just add up all the numbers and then that helps us give the age of the earth, for example. And so this isn't just something we're pulling out of thin air. This is actually, you can see this in the biblical text itself. One example, I think this is helpful because it's right there in the Torah, is you just go to the next book of the Bible in Exodus chapter 6, starting in verse 16. You have another small genealogy that's going to essentially get you to Moses and Aaron. Hmm. But what you see there in Exodus 6 is that Moses and Aaron are said to be the grandsons of a man named Kohath. But if you go back to the toward the end of the book of Genesis, Kohath was born before Jacob and the family arriving in Egypt in Genesis 46:11. Okay, so two data points right there. So if Kohath is the grandfather of Moses and Aaron, according to Exodus 6, but Kohath was born before Jacob and the family even get to Egypt in Genesis 46.
Which means he'd have to be like 600 years old.
He'd have to be pretty old, because then Exodus 12 says Israel was in Egypt for 430 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's at least 4 centuries there. But Moses was only 80 years old at the time of the Exodus, according to Exodus chapter 7. So when you kind of put all these pieces together, that means Moses was born 350 years after Kohath. If we're going to say Kohath was actually born in Genesis 46, like the text says, who could not have been then his grandfather, because Kohath, according to Exodus 6, only lived 133 years. So what scholars are going to point out is that even within Exodus 6, is there's very likely kind of skipping some ancestors or people in that genealogy. And, you know, we've talked about this before, like, you know, Matthew chapter 1, there's evidence there when you compare that to the book of Chronicles, that Matthew is skipping a few generations. So all I'm trying to say is that within the biblical text itself, you have evidence that when the biblical writers are compiling these genealogies, they're not necessarily going to include every single person in every single generation. They're often doing a little bit more that's, you know, kind of have to dig and do some work to kind of understand what's happening.
All right, another anecdotal example of how we do this even in our own day. We were talking yesterday with our friend and coworker Kevin Huddleston about his ancestors in England who mm-hmm. came from a particular part right. of England. And he was like, yeah, hey, one of my great grandfathers harbored, you know, Queen Mary when she was on the run. Well, obviously that wasn't his one of his great grandfathers, because that only goes back four generations. Yeah. And Queen Mary was on the run back in the 1500s. Yeah. So, but what he's doing is just saying, like, I'm related. I'm a descendant of this person who 500 years ago harbored, you know, Bloody Mary. And so you understand, like, we even do this as we talk about our own ancestors. We don't say, well, actually, Aaron, if you go back, you know, through my grandfather and then my great grand, we don't do the whole list, because that's not the point of the conversation. The point is to say, hey, that person's my ancestor.
Yep, exactly.
Hey, I got a question for you guys. First of all, thank you. Cause I've been sitting here for a couple of these podcasts and just learning a lot. These guys are preaching through Genesis. And so I know that some of our listeners have even shot emails saying, like, hey, thanks for kind of geeking out here, nerding out here. This is helpful. I have a question devotionally as I read my Bible. So I hit January 5 and I, you know, I come to these names and these numbers. What do you, like, pastorally, where do you want my mind to go devotionally if I don't have all of these commentaries? Yeah. And if I'm, let's just say I'm not going to do all the geeking out, right? Or the nerding out to study it. Where do I go devotionally with the Lord in this?
Yeah.
In these spots of scripture.
Yeah. You know, I think one thing that comes to mind is, first, this is hopefully a helpful reminder. Genealogies are a helpful reminder that what we have in front of us is true and historical. It can be more than that, but it's not less than true and historical. So I think that's one thing. I do think specifically, in addition to that, with Genesis 5, there's just a good reading strategy is that it seems to be repetitive, right, in Genesis 5, where it's, you know, so-and-so lived X amount of years, then he fathered a son at X amount of years, then he lived a total number of X amount of years. There's that repetition. But I think devotionally, noticing when that pattern stops, because oftentimes the biblical writers are wanting you to pay attention to both the repetition, but also the interruption. And so in Genesis 5, that pattern stops at three points. It's the image of God, that little section at the very beginning. It's the Enoch section right around verse 22. And then it's at the very end with the promise of rest. And so you have image of God, walking with God, and then rest with God. And so if I'm reading Genesis 5, you know, in the middle of January, in the middle of winter, it seems to be like those themes of what does it mean to be made in the image of God? What does it mean to walk with God? And what does it mean to find rest with God? Mm. Because it's the narrator is giving you, you know, yes, these are years and names and we can do all the geek out work for that. But I think the point the author is trying to drive for the people of Israel and by extension to us is image of God, walking with God, rest with God. And those are themes I think, you know, any Christian we should be dwelling on.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would simply add that I want the average devotional reader of the Bible to embrace the importance of formation. Mm. I've been reading through the Bible for 40 years. And when I was 21, there was a guy who discipled me who was a campus ministry guy who said, hey, just read through the Bible every year and then start over again the next year. And trust me that 10 years from now, you'll see a lot of things that that don't make sense to you now. And I just took his word for it. I was like, all right, you're older than me. I'll just do that. And so what I want people to embrace is sometimes when we think like, what's the devotional value? We're wondering like, how does this make me love God?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And what I want to help people see is actually this is just part of being a faithful Christian is just making this your story.
Yeah.
And what starts to happen is the more you read the Bible consistently, the more you start to see some of the connections that Aaron is making. Mm-hmm. Like you see that as a reader and you go, oh, you have a new set of questions. So it's not, if my goal is to come away from every text in the Bible, like, wow, that was deeply personally meaningful.
Yeah.
It's probably not the right goal. Mm-hmm. My goal should be I'm communing with God by attending to his word and by immersing myself in the story of his people. And over time, that has a formative effect on my soul, on how I see myself in the world, and even on things that start to jump out for me in the text of how I just see things I haven't seen before.
Yeah.
As a simple example, in Genesis 10, you have another set of genealogies. And in there, you notice in verse 4, the sons of Javan are Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. Okay, I don't know what most of those words mean, but I recognize one of them, Tarshish. What does that remind you of? Well, Jonah took a ship to Tarshish, right? And in Jonah, taking a ship to Tarshish is like getting away from the presence of the Lord. Let me get as far away from God as I can. Where do I go? I go to Tarshish. So that there's just a name there like, okay, I have a connection in the Bible from reading the book of Jonah that I know Tarshish is connected to the ocean and connected to seagoing peoples and connected to getting away from God. And so it's a little connection point that helps me see, oh, the Bible's telling one story, and these same names are going to resurface in various ways throughout the story. So I want people to embrace that. That's part of devotion, is loving the story and finding your place in it.
Yeah, that's good. And it's interesting because Genesis 10 is just full of detail.
Yeah.
And so you would, as an American at least, you would easily skip lots of stuff, right? Same with Matthew. You're just like, oh, genealogy, great. Mm-hmm. Let me get to Jesus.
Get to the good stuff.
Let me get to Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to your comment, Bob. I bet, I would suspect that when you got to Genesis 10:4, the sons of Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, it probably took a couple years until you were like, wait, Tarshish.
Yeah.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
That's good.
Yep.
Guys, this has been really helpful. And like I mentioned before, I've just been learning over here, and I think a lot of our listeners are appreciating it. The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thanks for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners, so if you have thoughts, questions, future podcast topics, you can send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.